KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I live in the Richmond District, San Francisco.
Ingleside, San Francisco.
East Oakland.
Coming up, we'll hear why so many people are upset by a new question in the 2020 census.
The addition of this question could be worse for California, because we're the state with the largest number of immigrants.
Then, why Arab Americans have been asking for their own census box to check.
If you're not counted, you don't exist. So if we are 3.7 million members in our community and we are being counted on 1.9, so what happened to the rest?
And we'll hear about a Berkeley coffee shop dedicated to helping resettle refugees.
We'd always thought that we would bring people in with coffee and then foster conversations around refugees, and it's actually been the opposite.
That's all coming up today on Cross Currents. The U.S. Census Bureau conducts a new count every decade, and the next one is coming up in 2020. The Bureau released the questions they intend to use last month, and one new question is causing a lot of debate. Here to explain what all the controversy is about and what it could mean for us locally is our immigration reporter, Nina Gensler-Debs. Hey, Nina.
Hi, Hannah.
So, Nina, what is this question that has so many people upset?
Well, there are a number of new or different questions, but the one most people are talking about is this person a citizen of the United States?
Okay.
And it's a question that actually got added late after a request was put in by the Justice Department for it to be added. There hasn't been a question about citizenship on a major U.S. census since 1950.
So why now? Why does the Justice Department want this? And why are people against it?
Well, here's former White House spokesperson Sarah Huckabee Sanders speaking about the decision when it happened.
We've contained this question that's provided data that's necessary for the Department of Justice to protect voters and specifically to help us better comply with the Voting Rights Act.
So basically what she's saying is that the Department of Justice wants the question, they say, to get better numbers on who is an American citizen, so who can legally vote. And if they have those numbers, they say they'll have accurate data to help protect against voter fraud.
Mm-hmm.
But there are a lot of people who do not think it's a good idea, including the city of San Jose, the city of San Francisco, the state of California, all of which are part of multiple lawsuits suing against the question.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, civil rights groups and Democrats are saying that the reasoning that the DOJ put forward is suspicious, or they think it's suspicious, because the DOJ says that it's trying to protect against the Voting Rights Act, which was enacted in the 60s to protect against discrimination of mostly black voters in the southern states.
Right.
But critics say, first of all, Attorney General Jeff Sessions doesn't have a history of being the biggest advocate for the Voting Rights Act.
Uh-huh.
He's called it, quote, intrusive. And also, we've always used estimates from different data to enforce the Voting Rights Act ever since it became a law. And so the combination of those factors plus the timing makes the critics suspect that this is a ploy to skew census numbers.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why everyone is so upset, is because all these people, politicians, activists, apparently even a former Census Bureau director, they oppose the question because they think it dramatically increases the likelihood of a bad count.
What's a bad count? What do you mean by a bad count?
Yeah, so that means if people are worried about filling out the census, they're worried that it might put them in legal jeopardy. They're worried about their ability to stay in the country because maybe you are an immigrant currently who doesn't trust the government so much and think that if you put that information out there, that it could jeopardize your ability to stay here.
Mm-hmm.
Then they won't fill it out. They won't fill out the census, and that means we won't have accurate numbers. And actually, another concern is families that have mixed status, right? So some families that might have people who are here on a visa or might have undocumented members, that the whole family will not fill out these census.
So you're losing a whole family.
Exactly.
In the count.
That's a concern. And actually, there have been times in the past where census data has been used to target certain populations.
Can you give us some examples?
So about 15 years ago, two historians discovered that the Census Bureau gave the Secret Service information about Japanese Americans living in the United States during World War II. There are laws against sharing that kind of information, but at that point, they were temporarily repealed with the Second War Powers Act of 1942. And these historians found that the Bureau provided information, sometimes even as specific as names and addresses, but mostly about what blocks people lived on, for people living in 7 states, including California. And then that information helped officials incarcerate more Japanese Americans in internment camps.
So that's a real concern.
Well, so census officials say that there are very strong protections in place now against sharing specific info with any other agencies, including ICE. Mm-hmm. Still, opponents of the question say it will further discourage an already fearful immigrant population from participating in something that's really important. And again, that would mean people are undercounted, which can have big effects both locally and nationally.
Like what?
So the purpose of the census is not only to count every resident in the U.S., but also to get other information from them, like age, race, whether a person rents or owns a home. And also a lot of research uses this number, lots of surveys that are conducted. So that information is used to determine a lot, like including how many seats states get in the House of Representatives, where federal funding goes, how legislative districts are drawn. So if that number is off, that can have really big consequences both politically and economically for places.
And I must say, we as journalists use this information a lot in our reporting.
Oh, absolutely. Tons of different entities.
So it'll affect the media narrative as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's likely that the addition of this question could be worse for California, because we're the state with the largest number of immigrants, mm-hmm. and the Bay Area has a particularly high number of immigrants. So populations that have more immigrants, where people might be more afraid to fill out the census, will be more drastically undercounted. So the less people it appears we have, the less it looks like we need funding or more political representation, which is what some critics think the DOJ might be trying to do. And according to City Attorney Dennis Herrera, federal researchers found that in the fiscal year of 2015, more than 130 programs used Census Bureau data to distribute more than $675 billion in funds for things like Medicaid, transportation projects, and the National School Lunch Program. Mm-hmm. So low-income families here could be hit pretty hard.
So, Nina, did anything else change about census questions this year?
Yeah, so several, and most of them have to do with identity. Mm-hmm. So, for example, people who identify as Hispanic, Latino, white, Asian Pacific Islander, or Black, they'll be asked to give some more information, like, are you of Puerto Rican origin, or German, or Vietnamese, or Jamaican? Also, now there's an option to indicate whether you're part of a, quote, opposite sex or same sex couple. Also, this year is different in that this is the first time the Census Bureau is really trying to encourage digital responses. Mm-hmm. So filling it out by computer or cell phones, and Americans won't have to fill it out by paper survey, although some will still receive it. There is concern about cybersecurity, but they're trying to get out ahead of that.
And so is all this finalized, or is there a chance that this question, the controversial citizenship question or others, might not make it onto the census?
Yeah, well, right now it's on there. But there is now a public hearing on May 8th on Capitol Hill where officials from the Commerce Department and the Census Bureau will have to appear before lawmakers and answer questions. And after that, we'll see what happens with these lawsuits.
All right. Thanks, Nina.
Thanks, Nina.
Nina Gensler-Debs is KLW's immigration reporter. You can reach her at immigration@klw.org. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. We just heard about new questions on Census 2020 and how some ethnic communities will have the chance to list their countries of origin. However, there's a group that's not getting that chance, despite asking for it for the past 8 years. It's people from North Africa and the Middle East. When filling out the U.S. Census, Egyptians, Moroccans, Iranians, and people from all over this region have always had to check the box white or other. There's no Middle Eastern or North African box. This has been problematic in a number of ways because these communities rely on representation when it comes to things like legislative redistricting counting or health statistics, in addition to the cultural inaccuracy of calling them white in the American context. The Arab American Institute and other groups petitioned the Census Bureau asking for a separate Middle East North Africa or MENA category in the 2020 census. That was rejected in January. So why is this important, and now what? One person who has been active in the campaign is the mayor of Foster City in San Mateo County, Sam Hindi, who is Palestinian American. He joined me in studio earlier today.
Based on the U.S. Census Bureau, there is 1.9 million Arab American in the U.S., while we believe the actual numbers are almost double that at 3.7 million. So there's a severe undercount of our community. And because of that severe undercount, we're not getting the services that we're supposed to be getting. So the effect of having us on the census would give us a positive impact on the treatment and services available to the Arab American community and remove the barrier to representation, education, health, and employment for the community.
How? Can you break that down, explain it to us?
Sure. So let's take the health issue for example. So it's currently impossible to address certain diseases that are related to this ethnic group, the Arab American and the Middle Eastern North African people. As probably you would know, there's like severe diabetic in our ethnic background. That is not addressed now because we're not classified as a class, if you will, or ethnic group. So there's no research, there's no funding available for this specific health issue that we have as a community. And then on the education, there's no equitable allocation of money and funding for, say, the assisted learning grants for assisted learning services for second language Arab Americans that come into the country. Employment, there would be, if we are counted as who we are, we will have employment assistance to lower income families, to those new immigrants that come into the country that classified as under the MENA category as well. So those are some of the issues. How would that impact our community in a positive manner if we were to be included in the census?
So the Arab American Institute is just one of the organizations that's been in talks with the Census Bureau since like 2010 even,
right,
about a separate MENA category. In 2015 is when the Census Bureau said it would start testing,
right,
this North Africa Middle East category for 2020. So it started this testing. And that testing had a lot of support from lots of Arab organizations, MENA organizations overall. But the rejection came early this year. Karen Battle, the chief of the Census Bureau's population division, said, quote, "We feel more research and testing is needed. That is why it was rejected."
Yeah.
So what do you make of this response?
No, I think, as you mentioned, it started in 2015. They've been testing. So that's a little bit more than 2 years of testing. And from my understanding, the testing was positive and all the reaction that we have gotten from the Census Bureau that it is needed. Those were the indication that we were getting. And quite frankly, I'm personally disappointed with this decision not to be included in 2020. How much more do we need? You have a problem. Like I said, we are severely undercounted. And when we are severely undercounted, we are not being, you know, for me, it's always been, if you're not counted, you don't exist. So if we are 3.7 million members in our community and we are being counted on 1.9, so what happened to the rest? They don't exist as far as the U.S. government is concerned. And this is a problem. And I think if you've done testing for the past 2.5 years, that's enough testing. It's time to take action.
And where do you get the 3.7 million number?
So this is a number from organizations such as what you named, the Arab American Institute and other Arab American organizations that have done their own, if you will, non-scientific census. That's why we want the Census Bureau to come in with the exact numbers. Mm-hmm. These are numbers we believe are close, but we want to verify those numbers and we want everybody to be counted like every other community in the United States. We're not asking for anything more, really.
Yeah, and actually, a number of other ethnic communities are getting kind of their own boxes, if you will. The census has included new categories, for example, specific African countries under the Black category. Which African country are you from?
Yeah.
For me, I'm lucky because I get to be part of the MENA and I get to be part of the
right.
Black community. So it's interesting for me. It's always been interesting in my family what to check, right?
Yes.
Like, I remember my parents saying they always checked other,
right?
Because they felt none of these categories represent them.
Yeah.
I'm wondering what you check.
Yeah, so when I first immigrated to the U.S., I don't know if there was other all the time. This was back in the 80s, but I looked white, Hispanic, you know, Native American, and so forth. None of those. So I said, it must be white, I guess. So check the white. Eventually, when I became aware of others, I would put Middle Eastern.
Mm-hmm.
I would write that down. But yeah, you check the box, and that's really very interesting and frustrating to a certain extent, because why are we not being counted?
Mm-hmm.
Why we're not white, we're not Hispanic, we're not Africans, we're not, you know, so we have to be counted.
I think I read also that in explanation of white, it was white, including those of Middle Eastern descent.
Yes.
What do you make of that?
Yeah, so I saw that. So that's why we were putting white. Now, if
yeah.
you say Caucasian, I know I'm not going to be Caucasian.
Right.
But probably if you say white in that sense to where, yeah, it includes Middle Eastern, so I guess we're white, but we don't believe we're white, so we don't feel like we're white,
mm-hmm.
because for us, white means Caucasian.
Yeah.
And we're not Caucasian, not that, we, you know, it's just we want to be
who
we are.
Not that there's anything wrong with
we want,
that.
Exactly, we want to be who we are. That's it.
To what extent do you think this rejection reflects the current political climate?
Probably it has quite a bit to do with it. I really don't know. I'm not privy to a lot of information as to what went through the decision-making process. But I wouldn't be surprised, and it's not far-fetched to say politics did play a role.
Yeah. I'm also hearing some people say they would actually not want more detailed information about themselves because of this current political climate. It's just like a year after President Trump issued travel bans against countries that are in the MENA category, Sudan, Iran, Libya, Syria, Yemen. Is it different times from when the issue initially started? Maybe I don't want more details of myself.
Yeah. No, I can understand that, and especially coming from the political climate back home. People don't They're always scared. They don't want to be singled out. They don't want to be involved in any political action because that spells trouble. So you kind of see our community really shying away from being politically involved or being activists, right? Because they always worry about the repercussions. But I think those people who are sensitive, and I understand why, because of the political climate in the country since mm-hmm. Trump's election.
Mm-hmm.
However, they probably, I would venture to say, they don't understand what is it we are missing as a community because we're not being counted.
Are you hopeful for 2030, including a MENA category on the census?
I hope so. I could tell you one thing is we will not stop working hard to get that done because of the importance of what it means to our community. And it, in my opinion, it's only just. It is really a justice for us to be counted. So we will continue to work hard, and we will not give up. And that's what it is. It didn't happen now in 2020, but we'll continue the journey.
Sam Hindy is the Palestinian-American mayor of Foster City in San Mateo County. Find more information about the census at klw.org. Click Cross Currents. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. Many immigrants come to the Bay Area as refugees, and those who resettle here have to secure jobs quickly to make their rent. That can be difficult with a limited resume and references. And to help bridge that gap, a coffee company in Berkeley is providing job training and employment to refugees and asylees one cup at a time. It's the brainchild of co-founders Rachel Tabor and Doug Hewitt. And the mission of the cafe is more than providing employment for refugees. It's about educating the entire community by offering a space where people can meet and share their stories. In this story we originally aired last year, KLW's Jeremy Ju has more.
For here to go?
To go.
You want a room for tea? $4.
Nazira Bobery moves around the 1951 coffee shop with ease, mixing, steaming, grinding coffee, whipping up espressos and almond milk lattes like a pro. But the truth is, she's new to this. And not so long ago, she was in a very different place.
You know, my last job was with United Nations as a communication consultant.
Before that, she worked as a journalist in Afghanistan, her home country. There, she had everything.
I had home, family, friend, job, career, everything, but I was not safe.
Her husband felt threatened because of his job. And so last year, even though she really didn't want to, they left. On December 5th, Bobery arrived in San Francisco. She became one of nearly 4,000 special immigrant visa holders resettled in California in 2016. And even as an experienced traveler with an apartment waiting for her in the Bay Area, she still had a really hard time adjusting.
You know, for 1 month, I really struggled a lot.
She worried about friends and family back home, felt childlike in her inability to communicate. And the isolation, stress, and helplessness wore on her. She didn't leave her house.
You know, staying at home 24 hours is the most difficult thing. For 2 weeks, I just got sick. I just cried and said, I want to do something.
So she reached out to the International Rescue Committee and told them exactly what she needed.
See, if you really want to do something for me, I need a job.
And then someone there connected her to where she's working right now. A coffee company in Berkeley with a mission to employ refugees.
When refugees first come in, one of the most crucial pieces is helping them find a job.
That's Doug Hewitt. He and Rachel Tabor founded 1951 Coffee Company after working at the International Rescue Committee.
The U.S. government expects for them to be economically self-sufficient within about 6 months of arrival. And so finding that job as soon as possible is critical.
This means shortly after arriving, a refugee is expected to pay their rent, repay their plane ticket, and find a job quickly. And it is this urgency, Rachel Tabor explains, that really limits their employment opportunities.
Regardless of someone's background, be it they were a lawyer, a doctor, a farmer, a teacher, an accountant, it doesn't matter what role they played in their home country, they will find an entry-level position when they arrive.
So Tabor and Hewitt brainstormed ways they could help refugees find jobs, and the coffee industry kept coming up. The positions are forward-facing, so newcomers can work on their English. Plus, Oakland is one of the nation's major coffee ports where tons of unroasted green coffee beans are stored.
And San Francisco and Oakland are the first and third respective highest-paying barista incomes in the country.
So they founded the 1951 Coffee Company. Hewitt says they named it after the year the United Nations first defined the guidelines for the protection of refugees.
We saw that as a very inspirational moment historically, and we want to be a part of that protection and that ongoing, you know, building process for them.
They initially launched a training program to get as many refugees into the coffee industry as possible. Then, earlier this year in January, just 5 days before President Trump's immigration ban, they opened their own cafe, the 1951 Coffee Shop.
We have 10 baristas from 7 different countries. That represents 7 different refugee communities that are here in the Bay Area.
And Nazira Bobery is one of them. And right now, she's mixing up a cappuccino with her colleague, Meg Karki, a refugee from Bhutan. Their shared experience as refugees creates a sense of support.
We feel like a family because we don't have family here, but we make a new family here, like if everyone just take care of each other.
And that's evident in the way they interact. As they prep an iced latte, around them sit customers of all different ages, all different backgrounds, sipping on their lattes, engaged in conversation. learning about the challenges that refugees face through the infographics that decorate the walls. Here's Tabor again.
We'd always thought that we would bring people in with coffee and then hopefully foster conversations around refugees and the support, and it's actually been the opposite of that. More the support of refugees are what drawing people in.
And Bulberry and the other baristas see that, and it makes them feel good.
Some of them want to know, where are you from? They want to know about the stories, about the situation. And at least they gave a comment that life gonna be okay, don't worry. These comments make us happy.
That's not to say Bulberry feels completely at home now, or isn't sometimes frustrated with what she's had to leave behind. But compared to 3 months ago, she's in a better place.
16-ounce chai latte.
Happy that she is back to work and hopeful for the future. For Cross Currents, I'm Jeremy Ju.
Jeremy made that story last year as part of KELW's Audio Academy. And by the way, we're currently accepting applications for next year's class. Learn more at kalw.org. And that's our show. Today's Cross Currents team includes Nina Gensler-Debs, Angela Johnston, Amber Miles, Lisa Morehouse, Christine Nguyen, True Nguyen, Marissa Ortega-Welch, and Josh Wilson. Our engineers are James Rowlands, Gabe Graben, and Jackie Sajiko. The line producer is Liza Veal. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. This music is by Carly Marley, who started writing songs when she was 13 in her L.A. bedroom. Now she lives in San Francisco, and she'll perform here at El Rio tomorrow night. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.